Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Alan Parker said, "Sometimes, with the British film industry, it's hard to know if we're waving or drowning. Let's find out."
Hi, just interrupting the start of this podcast to let you know that I've split the interview I did with Simon Rumley about his 2010 film Red, White and Blue into two separate podcasts. So, you're now listening to Two of Two. Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today we've got a special Halloween show, and I've got Simon Rumley in the house.
Hello.
Quite literally.
In the house. Yeah. In the living room.
In the living room of my house. Watching this week, getting ready for this, I began to see how serious Nate was from the get-go. And obviously, yep, he's not a bloody comedy character at any point.
Yeah, yeah.
But he is a man that just... Because obviously, if you've... Dishonourable discharge is obviously code for I went over the edge and I needed,
yep,
a break.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sorry, honourable discharge, not dishonourable.
Yeah.
Honourable discharge from the army, which is you didn't get chucked out, but really,
yeah,
you,
yeah,
couldn't be kept in.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
obviously, this is post-Gulf War and stuff where...
Yeah,
we've now seen the pictures that ended up in the papers of what atrocities and,
yeah,
Zero Dark 30 has been made, and that sort of shows you.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can imagine that Nate's character is that.
Yeah,
is that,
yeah. Is that well, yeah. He's the guy who never existed. You know, if the truth came out,
yeah,
he never existed. No one ever knew who he was. And so he is a psychopath, but somehow a controlled psychopath, which again I've you know is. Because you often think serial killers, you know, aren't controlled, but of course to a point, you know, they have to be for the most of the time because they because otherwise they would be caught straight away. It's just like from time to time they lose control.
Dennis Rader's quote about the BTK killer. They asked him, "Why did you stop killing for 8 years?" He said, "Oh, you know what it's like. It's really hard to be a serial killer when you're married and got a kid."
Yeah, yeah, yeah. who was that?
Dennis Rader, BTK killer.
And in
the book about his story, like that quote just stood out as like,
yeah,
yeah, it was just a job for him. I mean, it's,
yeah, yeah,
it's,
yeah,
horrendous. But
well, it's like, you know, allowing us. Well, I'm not an expert on these things, but one imagines it's like turning on or even off a valve. Mm. And you do it from time to time, but then, you know, do serial killers think about this stuff all the time? Maybe, maybe not. But, you know, certainly, I don't think all of them do. And certainly, you know, someone can stop, you know, and there are, you know, various serial killers throughout history who have stopped for...
Is there a version of Red, White and Blue where Erica doesn't get caught by the exits of her and Nate going off into the sunset? Does that exist then in your mind? Because obviously the fly in that ointment of their happiness is,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
the exits,
yeah,
come looking for Erica.
Yeah, well, they never did. But then you know, I guess it would be interesting because would it become then a kind of natural born killers of sorts?
Yeah.
But you know, that's not something that ever really crossed my mind because,
yeah,
it felt that, you know, she needed to die, and it just felt right how I did, yeah, it. You know.
So one of the. You said you've been to Texas, and this was shot digital, wasn't it?
It was the red camera, yeah.
Yeah. Now, what's amazing with it being digital technology is that it feels, because of the warmth of the colour palette you've chosen with Milton, it feels very filmy, for want of a better word.
Yeah, yeah.
What were your conversations about the look and feel with Milton when you were looking at how Red, White and Blue should look to the audience?
My memory is that I think whether it was City of God, it might have been City of God, I think there was I can't quite remember, but there was a few films that we... Oh, Amoris Peros, I think, maybe Seed of God, which were very realistic, kind of stark, realistic films, but where the colour, everything just really was... The colour was emphasised, really, and everything was just kind of brightened that little bit. And because of course, Austin is naturally a sunny place, it felt like we couldn't do it in any other way, really. You know, it wanted to be naturalistic. And, you know, in Austin, there is a lot of colour. So rather than... And also, you know, because the film was so dark in itself, the last thing we wanted to do is make it like, you know, Seven, where it was all just, you know, dark and raining every all the time. Not that we could have afforded, you know, all that artificial rain, but it just felt, you know, I think Milton and myself both like making all our films look different. And certainly if you go through our films, you know, from The Living Dead to Red, White and Blue to Fashionista to Crowhurst, you know, they're all pretty distinctive looks, and Bitch, and you know, and I find that part of, you know, directing and the tools of a director is to, you know, a lot of directors just seem to, you know, generally have, you know, the same look in every film, give or take a bit of a grade, but I always think, you know, coloring is part of what, of course, and cinematography is of course what identifies.
How much of what I see is what's in camera, and how much of it is what you did after the shot?
It was pretty much all in camera. But of course, you know, when we went into the grade, I think we kind of hit the contrast, whacked that up. You know, made the blacks heavier and stuff to give it a bit more intensity. But you know, as opposed to Fashionista, for example, or actually even Crowhurst. Well, some of Crowhurst was in camera, certainly the effects, but the grading of both those films was pretty heavily, was pretty heavy, to be honest. And certainly something like Fashionista, you know, that was one of the few films that we found the grade as we were doing it, rather than most of the films, this one included, you know, we both had a very specific discussion and knowledge of what we wanted to do and where we went with it. But yeah, you know, and Milton's great, you know, he very much uses natural light, his quick, you know, doesn't, you know, it's more like with him, it's more about taking a light bulb out of a switch, rather than putting, you know, five lights, you know, behind whatever. He's kind of very much less is more, and, you know, lighting by taking stuff away rather than, you know, putting stuff in. As a very rough rule of thumb. But, you know, again, you know, Austin being Austin, you know, as I said, you know, the natural light there is pretty great. So we took advantage of that as much as we could.
Now, in amongst all like the writing of the whole, but then the way you present it is, and you start as you mean to go on, as it were, I think it's something like the first 5 minutes is more like a kind of, is more lyrical than it is than it is talky.
Yeah.
Because we're not hearing anyone. We're seeing people talk. But we're not hearing a word they're saying. You've imposed a set of music over the top of it.
Yeah.
And that's a motif you continue throughout. So at that point, it's quite innocent. It's mysterious. And then later on, when we're hitting, or we're dropping into the emotional troughs that you send us into, you then rely on that same approach, which is to take away the real sound, impose music of a kind of that marries up with the emotion, see people in the way they're reacting, but not hearing them. So nothing's ever over-explained in that nature, but how did it, because some of the, obviously we're dealing in big things and things that ruin people's lives, but you didn't feel the need to want to let us hear people go, in effect, you've got rid of all the why me bits and
you've
allowed us to understand that's why me, but actually you've made us focus on the reaction of the actor.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's an interesting question. I think, you know, I suppose that's, you know, the power of having a script that I wrote, which I directed and I produced. You know, I could do what I want with it, and with the kind of belief that the audience is going to get it, you know, and rather than sometimes, you know, it's like, well, but we can't put music over that because then we can't hear what they're saying. And in my mind, at some point, it's you know, it's a very interesting game to play. At some point, you know, when does dialogue become redundant? You know, when do you need to hear people explain stuff, which is when it becomes, you know, essentially exposition, as we know as writers. exposition sometimes is needed, but often it's incredibly clumsy. And the film is essentially, you know, it's an emotional journey, really, and does, you know, having someone explain something a little bit more help that emotional journey? In reality, probably not. You know, you get the idea of what's going on. So I don't think there's anything that we glossed. Well, there was no dialogue that we got rid of by doing that, you know, which was actually important to the story. But I think, again, by a certain point, you understand what's going on.
Where were you taking your cues for that in terms of an idea? Was it something you... Because you use it as a motif throughout, but like I say, the one that sprung to mind this week, certainly with the opening bit, it's similar to how Antichrist begins, like this.
Well, I did do this before Antichrist, of course.
For me, that idea of the, and he does the same in Melancholia as well.
To be honest, I couldn't say it's such a long time ago. I mean, the one thing that I do remember is that the way the film starts is the editing. You know, you flash forward by a couple of scenes, or even a couple of, you know, a few minutes in that scene, and that's the way that's cut, and that was very specifically taken from.
What's better like that? That idea where you put us in the future, then just take us back a moment.
And
get us back in the scene.
Which is exactly that unsettling. From the music at the beginning, which is unsettling, to then doing that, it kind of off balances. But that was very much taken from the Getaway, which was directed by Sam Peckinpah. And also, you know, it actually goes back to my fascination with Nicholas Roeg, and that's, you know, he, and so my idea with Red, White, Blue is, well, I've always wanted to do a film where you play with the time structure, but how hard is it going to be to do that over a whole film, but hey, I'm going to at least, you know, I'm going to take, you know, rather than being Roegian, I'm going to do, you know, something like Sam Peckinpah did in The Getaway, and which gives it its own kind of atmosphere, and as you say, a lyricism, but also kind of unsettling kind of atmosphere. But at some point, I was like, well, there's no way we can do that for the whole film, so fuck it, you know, do it for the first 5 minutes, and of course, so again, that, you know, of course, I did it in the end more with Crowhurst, and then even Fashionista was the whole film. So whether anyone else liked it or not, I at least achieved my own ambition of doing.
From a filmmaker point of view, though, are you shooting these scenes as they were written down on the page, and then deciding you don't need it in the edit, and thinking I'm going to put it together this way, or are you shooting scenes where you're not bothering trying to even capture the dialogue?
Bit of both, to be honest. Okay. I mean, you know, so, you know, quite, because again, I mean, quite often. So quite often, you know, I'll say just talk, but we won't even bother recording dialogue. And then sometimes actors get a bit confused if they're asked to talk, but they're like, what are we saying? And I'm like, well, you're in a bar, you know, just say what you'd be saying to your mate in a bar. And so that usually takes a while. Usually I'm with the sound design, you know, it's not like I have every single thing worked out, but I have a rough idea what's going to happen. And for me, you know, the sound design and the score are as much a part of making something, you know, disturbing or uncomfortable as any kind of writing or indeed, you know, violence.
Now there's sort of sicker things that happens as we get to the sort of nub of Nate's journey after the demise of Erica, is that she's not whole. She's not whole. Erica is no longer one body. Yes,
yeah. Not whole.
And it's quite... It's never sort of... what do you call it? He never actually says it. He just goes to each band member and says, where's Erica?
Yeah.
Which is kind of brilliant. It's kind of a... Because we're kind of... At first, you're kind of like... Well, you know her, can I reckon? She was in the boot of that guy's car. The head's in the fridge. Or the
yeah.
What do you imagine for Nate that he is? He is it just a kind of proxy for him then putting Erica back together again to kill them, or is it for him more about putting Erica back together again, even though obviously she's dead?
Well. Interesting question. I mean, I think in the end it was more out of respect that, you know, she is his wife, and if he's going to bury her, he doesn't want to just bury a leg. You know, he wants to bury the whole body, so to at least give her some kind of, you know, vague repose from her fate, really, and respect and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's a genuine desire for him to actually find all of her. Yeah, very much so.
Now, one of the things that might surprise you as a viewer of the film is that I figure it's there's a whole load of restraint in Red, White and Blue.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the violence in it is implied rather than given to us on the screen. And and the reward for that, and reward sounds like an awful word, is obviously Frankie's death, which you don't shy away from at all.
Yeah.
I mean, it's as a kind of journey from there, in terms of how you show violence in Red, White and Blue, and the journey from some of the early moments too. So you've got Nate wanting to protect Erica in the workplace. All you see Nate do is get a ball and a hammer and go into a public toilet when Erica's leaving. And we know that clearly the fella in the toilet's going to get his head mashed in.
Yeah.
We don't see it. We don't need to see it.
Well, it's funny because, you know, people call it violent film. When it was on the festival circuit, you know, people were like, wow, this is such a violent film. And I kept saying that actually it isn't, you know, conceptually it is, but all of the actual, the majority of violence is off screen. And even with actually, you know, the climax. And I did a talk at Raindance about this, you know, about that climactic scene. And one of the reasons I did the talk is because I was inspired by Takashi Miike's audition. I thought, you know, I'll do this, you know, which was, again, another really slow burner. And it's essentially a drama throughout, you know, probably 80% of the film. And then the first 20 minutes go pretty crazy. Hmm. And I was like, I like that because, you know, I like that build up and I think it works. So I wanted to do the same in Red, White, Blue. And so on the written page, the climax of Red, White, Blue is way more graphic and
is it?
Yeah. Well, because what it does is it actually describes, you know, fully pulling, you know, pulling off the guy's skin, which involves, you know, pliers and all that kind of stuff. And when we came to shoot it, the VFX and that we had done for us weren't good enough for us to make that happen. So in the end, and for a time, I was you know, fairly distraught because, like, you know, shit, this is the climax of the film and this is just really not working. But then at some point, I don't know if it was in the edit or whenever it was, at some point I was like, you know what, actually, the film is actually very emotional, especially given how I think the performances are so great. And we get the idea, you know, what's happening in that climactic scene. Mm. We don't need to see it all. It's going to be a lot stronger if we don't see it all, because at some point, I mean, you know, I don't think with Audition it became, you kind of got turned off by the violence, but that was, you know, you're shocked by it, but that was almost the whole point. Mm. And this was like, it actually ends up being much stronger if we see that violence, we see why he's doing it, and then we cut away to Erica and him and her just cuddling, basically, because then it highlights the tragedy of it. So even that final scene, it's basically a lot of cutaways, of you know, close-up cutaways, but it was definitely meant to be a lot more graphic. And in the end, you know, sometimes these things that seem pretty bad at the time, of course, work out for the better.
I think it's more because that the greater sense of it comes from that initial scene with the family, where Nate's got Ed and his wife and the young girl, and obviously he does what you don't want him to do. He begins to take it out on the young girl.
Yeah.
And
we had actually a very big distributor in America who apparently loved the film, and then decided that they couldn't take it because that the CEO of the company likes children.
do lots of us not?
Yeah, well, exactly. that was another, you know, there was a lot of surreal decisions made after that film was made by distributors and
because people. That sequence is where is the for us the audience, this is the realization that Nate isn't fucking around.
Yeah, and by most accounts, and myself included, you know, that's in a way that's the most harrowing scene. Because you've got this little girl who's amazing, you know, and you know, it's looking like, well, Nate asks her that question, you know.
Do you want to survive or die like Mummy and Daddy?
It's like, do you want to live without your parents or die with them?
Absolutely. But again, I think this comes down to the fact that your film achieves emotional violence more than the physical violence. So we give so much of a shit about everybody in it. Because at this point, Ed and his bandmates have killed and chopped up Erica.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, he's not an innocent, obviously, the wife and kid are.
Yeah.
But Nate's got to get answers, and obviously being a keen torturer, he, from his military experience,
he knows what he's doing.
He knows what to do. So he's only doing what, I mean, I say only, it sounds like I'm validating it, but he is only doing what a torturer would do to get the information.
Yeah.
So it's kind of weird that you play with our moral values.
Yes.
Even when the morals have already gone askew.
Yeah. It's a double.
Are you, but in that sense, because that's like beyond the, that's not beyond at all, it's the reason for the drama, I suppose. On the page, are you confident of that dance you're making with us?
I think so. I mean, again, you know, the script, you know, most of my films, not all of them, depending on, you know, if I have final cut or not, but certainly the films I have final cut on, they're very close to the script. Mm. You know, I think we usually lose a couple of scenes here or there, or even a handful of scenes, and usually take, you know, change around one or two scenes, but the script on all the films I've done are incredibly close to the final version. So I guess so. You know, I mean I'm aware, you know, I think in a lot of reviews I always read, you know, that there's a very fine line between what I'm doing and where it could go wrong, but you know, I think...
Well, give us an example. What's an example of that, where someone pointed that out in a review that you've sort of...
I mean something like I suppose, you know, The Living Dead, and, you know, some people, you know, I guess they thought all the speeded up stuff was a bit too much, and, you know, it's this kind of quite hysterical film in its own way, and you know, which could just be too much, and for some people it probably is, I'm sure. But the people, of course, who like it are like, well, it's that very fine line between being this hysterical mess and this absolutely moving, emotionally draining thing. I mean, I've seen that in a few kind of comments over the years.
It's fascinating that, because, I mean, I don't know if this speaks about volumes to me or not, but I'm not always there to be entertained, and I think a visceral reaction to a visceral film is a valid reaction.
Very, very much so, and I kind of agree. You know, I mean, I have much, you know, sometimes it's of course you go to the cinema and you want it to be entertained, but by the same token, you know, being entertained can be coming out of it crying or coming out of it being disturbed and
thought provoking is entertaining.
Yes, exactly. And I think, you know, but then not everyone wants to see these kind of films because actually they don't want to be, you know, provoked. And
should they watch them.
And they don't want to be disturbed because they wonder why. I mean, I remember seeing Bad Lieutenant when it came out in London, and it was in one of those kind of porn cinemas on Piccadilly Circus. Hmm. And I went with a school friend. And I came out of thinking, oh my God, that was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And he came out of thinking, oh my God, why would anyone want to ever make that or watch that? And you know, and we're friends, and it's amazing. But of course, therein lies the difference, you know, in two friends who are viewers. It's like I wanted to be, you know, damaged and disturbed by film, and he unchallenged, and he really did not. But you know, obviously the film did do that to him, but he just didn't like what it caused in him.
Well, one last question then on that aspect then. So this film obviously did a good healthy tour of the festivals and stuff.
Mm.
So you're there. That's where you get to live and breathe it with people watching it.
Yeah.
What were some of the extreme reactions you were able to sort of gauge from, say, Q&As and stuff that you had?
Well, I can tell you we had one reaction actually in Austin, and which was slightly hampered by the fact that it was at the Alamo, and I think there was Amanda was there, I was there, Bob the producer was there, I think the sales agents was there, I think maybe Tim Lee, who's exec producer and owned the cinema, was there, There was actually, maybe Mark Sent was there, there was a lot of us. And we'd gone into the nearby bar and had a couple of vodka martinis because some bright spark decided that they wanted to know the difference between shaken and stirred. So we all kind of decided, you know, to go down that route. And we hadn't eaten, and then we came back for the Q&A afterwards. And we were quite drunk, to be honest. And especially in America, the vodka martinis tend to be bigger than they are over here. And so it's probably like having like a, you know, 8 shots of vodka on an empty stomach. And we got up on stage and had a few questions, and then a girl asked me a question, something like, you know, what were you trying to achieve with this film? And I was thinking, good question. And then I was thinking, fuck, I actually don't think I can answer this. Because I don't think I've got the ability to talk because I'm that drunk. Even though mentally I was working okay, but
hear the gears grind.
I could, yeah. And I to myself I thought, well, I've just got to answer this as succinctly as possible. And so I said, you know, to get a reaction. And then she started saying why she didn't like the film, and then she burst into tears. But then she started kind of shouting these answers. Oh, sorry, these questions at me and everyone. We're all like, oh, you know, what's going on? And especially because she was kind of, yeah, shouting these things and not giving pause for any kind of response whatsoever. And I was thinking, oh my God, you know, she's either been raped herself or she's had some kind of trauma that a boyfriend's gone through in the army or maybe she's got HIV and she's crying and oh my God. And then Amanda stepped in and, you know, because as a writer-director, you know, you always think of it as your film. But of course, at some point, you know, as soon as you get the actors on board, especially, and all the cast, you know, the rest of the cast and the crew, you know, you hand it over and it's not just your film, it's everyone's films. And, you know, and it's as much Amanda's film as anyone's film, of course. Mm-hmm. And because she put, you know, her heart and soul into that film. And it was a very, you know, tough film for her to do for obvious reasons. So, and she loved, you know, Erica as a character and really identified with her fragility and all that kind of stuff. So she started, you know, well, hang on, just calm down here. I'd like to answer some of your questions. So she did. And then I think this woman started shouting over her. And people, you know, a few people started booing at this woman. And she was getting more and more hysterical. And in the end, Tim, who was our exec producer and also owned the cinema, the Alamo, he was like, you know, this is like 5 minutes into this. He's like, you know what? Just get out. Just fuck off out of my cinema. You don't come here and insult me and my friends. Just get out. Get out right now. I don't want you here. I don't want you to ever come to the Alamo again. And everyone kind of went quiet. And the guy, I think it was the guy this woman was with. He was, you know, he's like, okay, I think we should go now. So literally, he kind of escorted this woman out. And there was absolute silence. And, you know, everyone was watching her and we're all a bit, you know, we're a bit like, what the fuck's going on? You know, Tim was, and I remember Tim kind of whispering to me like, you know, a minute later going, oh my God, I can't believe I just told a paying customer to fuck off out of my cinema. And then she finally left. And again, there was like a couple of seconds of like, what do we do now? And then someone started clapping and then the whole audience started clapping and cheering. And so that was the kind of craziest time. And I remember Ain't It Cool News, there was a review in it, actually by Harry Knowles, who's a, you know, persona non grata these days.
Yes, indeed.
But for a long time was, you know, was considered to be, well, you know, the kind of champion film critic, or certainly of online for a long time. Mm. And he reviewed the next day the film. And you know, I always remember that because I was like, wow, that's what an amazing quote. He said, you know, I've always heard about films that could break a person and break their psyche. And up until this day, I've never believed that was true. But last night, I saw this happen with a woman after she watched Red, White, and Blue. And she came in a normal person. She left a broken woman or a broken person. And you know, obviously, my intention making films isn't to go around breaking people mentally or otherwise. But I did think, okay, that's, you know, what an amazing response. And to this day, I still, you know, for me as a filmmaker at the time, I was just thinking, and being up on stage and seeing her, well, incredibly emotional, visceral reaction was, I was like, oh my God, you know, I feel really bad for her because she didn't know what she was coming to see. And so whatever is in the story, it's obviously hit a very personal nerve. Mm. And to this day, I don't know, you know, she didn't stick around. We didn't, I think we found a few people who kind of knew who she was,
yeah.
But no one quite knew what was going on with her. So we never quite found out why, but that was, you know, with the living and dead again, I went around the world with it and there was a few different stories, but stories from South Africa and Romania and a few other places where people really responded to the characters and something to do with their parents dying. But that, you know, which are actually very emotional, kind of very, which really kind of touched me as kind of responses to the film.
Was that kind of a first time then that you'd felt there was some responsibility on the filmmaker when you're making a film? Because obviously there's the kind of, I guess, whole nihilistic view is that you've got no responsibility because we're all adults and you see the certificate, you can read the synopsis and you can make a decision.
Well, I mean, I mean, of course, you know, every filmmaker has a responsibility. Quite what that responsibility is probably more open to debate.
Hmm.
And I can't say that I had a responsibility, you know, to make a film that wouldn't upset anyone. I mean, again, one of the reasons for making the film was to make a disturbing film, you know, and I, as someone who loves, you know, the widest range of what horror films are, do I think these are horror films? To your point, but not entirely. But they do disturb people, but I think that's different from scaring people. You know, to me, a horror film is something that scares you. But of course, there are other films. You know, Requiem for a Dream is an incredibly disturbing film, for example.
Mm.
You know, is it a horror film? Maybe, maybe not. But you know, I so what is the responsibility of the filmmaker? It's not to not disturb people. I think it's just to, yeah, you know, it's a big question. I don't quite know what the responsibility of the filmmaker is apart from just to, you know, really do the best they can, true to their vision, I suppose. Then of course you've got to ask, you know, is the vision something that should be, you know, be implemented? Is maybe a different question. But
no, and I've wrestled with this one, and I'm not settled on a comfortable conclusion at all.
Mm, mm.
I think there's always the context of the time you're making it.
Yeah.
Which is going to lend some weight. You know, there are certain countries around the world right now that you can't do what you can do in the UK. So clearly, you're going to make different movies anyway for that reason alone. And then you've got the individual subjectivity that comes into it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, the whole question of violence in films is always a, you know, an interesting one. And swearing in films and you know, sometimes you do look at some films and just think, you know, we don't need, you know, to hear another swear word, and we don't need to see another piece of violence. And if it's a character trait, or you know, then there are, as we've discussed, you know, you don't have to show every single piece of violence as it happens. You know, you can show it off
but what's
off camera.
It,
and
I was going to say, but from obeying the laws of drama as well as show, make it lead into violence is the way you've constructed your story is that all the violence in the movie is justified by difficult choices characters are making.
Mm.
Nobody is a cold-hearted killer.
No.
Looking to kill people for kicks.
No.
Because it may be that you don't reveal until Erica sat in a chair that she's been abused since she was four. But it's once you know that piece of information, everything else up to that point kind of makes sense.
And it makes sense. Yeah.
It doesn't justify it.
No.
But it makes sense in terms of what difficult decisions a person makes when that's the foundation to build a life off. Equally, if you come home and find that your mother leaves you a note after committing suicide saying, better off without me,
yeah,
and you know it was you that pushed you over the edge, then the decisions that Frankie makes after are wholly justified.
Yeah, yeah.
In Frankie's immediate reaction. Obviously, if he could take time out and go and sit in a cold bath for 2 hours...
Well, and the whole idea is to understand, you know, and again, I've, you know, I've done this with most of my films, you know, with the ABCs of Death, which is a 5-minute short film. You know, the idea was to get a character who basically you know, squashes animals for a living. You know, on for a
thanks for introducing that thought to me, by the way.
Yeah, for on a fetish site, and just thinking, and you know, and me just, you know, finding out about these things and thinking, you know, why on earth would someone do this? You know, is there ever, you know, why, you know, is there a reason that actually are these people just complete cold-hearted psychopaths, or actually is there a reason that maybe someone did it for ulterior motives? Doesn't make what they actually do okay, no, but does it go to explain a bit of psychology as to life isn't all black and white, and you know, bad things that happen often are for bad reasons, but sometimes are more justified than others, and I find it interesting to try and justify these bad things. Not to say that, you know, I want everyone to go, well, these guys who killed this woman, you know, are it's fine because they had good reasons. Of course not, but it just makes, you know, an audience think a little bit more, because yeah, behind every story there's always more than one side to that story, and as I said, you know, black and white is not really something that exists outside of often the movies, to be honest.
True. You know? Well, look, thank you very much for making Red, White and Blue.
It's an
amazing
pleasure.
Piece of film.
Thank you very much.
And I'm glad I got the chance to talk to you about it after the fact.
Yeah, brilliant.
Obviously, people can get this freely available DVD, Blu-ray and the like. Is that generally speaking now? I mean, I got mine a while ago.
Well, I don't... Well, the whole release in this country was a bit of a disaster, because the guy who bought it for the distributors then left the company, and then the person who then took over the company absolutely hated the film, so pretty much did all that he could to not release it. But it was never released on Blu-ray in this country, but I believe it's on DVD still. And I guess it's on iTunes. You can buy it on Amazon and iTunes. It was on Netflix, but no longer. It was on Shudder, but not at the moment. So I think at the moment those are the two sites.
Well, look, dear listener, if you want yourself a good harrowing tragedy, then I think look no further than Red, White and Blue.
Yeah, if you've stuck it out this far, yeah, you know where to go.
Thank you very much, Simon.
Thank you. Excellent.